1, 2, 3. Ah, don't worry about that. That's just a little jiu-jitsu thing. And the first of about 104 different jiu-jitsu references in this pod, where I am chatting to doctor, business owner, blue belt, and all-round good guy, Ash Hilton. Amongst other things, we chat suffering from burnout and some of the ways that that can manifest itself. That fine line between working hard and overdoing it, insecurity and low self-esteem, and a couple of things that have helped offset some of those feelings in our lives. And then we finish with an attempted profound quote that I spend about 7 minutes trying to remember and eventually semi-butcher. But anyway, hope you enjoy. Ashley Hilton.
Hello, sir.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I think the standard podcast response is always, I'm always excited to be here. I'm really excited.
Well, I'm very excited to have you here. And it must actually be nice for you sat opposite the table from me, as opposed to being absolutely smashed under me on the jiu-jitsu mats.
Oh, yeah, that happens. Yeah, all the time. Yeah, can't get enough of that.
intro. What's your name? Where are you from? And what do you think the largest animal is that you could beat in a fight?
Oh, good question. So I'll start with my name, Ashley Hilton. And I suppose I say I'm from Birmingham. I've grown up, kind of, I've lived in Belgium. We talked about, you know, you growing up in Luxembourg. I grew up in Belgium for a big part of my childhood. But I say Birmingham because that's where the accent has stuck. Yeah. Biggest animal, I think, like, if I could catch and beat up a wild boar, I think that would be...
You back yourself.
I mean, animals are freakishly strong. Oh, and, you know, I'd love... did you watch that jiu-jitsu show? Talking of jiu-jitsu.
Main theme show? Of this conversation, yeah. Definitely.
There was a show called Up Next, and yeah. They got all the kind of like new hot shots that were amateurs that they were trying to...
Where was our call up for this?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, they must have missed me on that day. I'm not quite sure. But so they tried to get them to all wrestle a bull to the ground, a baby bull. And one of them did it, just one guy did it, and he was not the beefiest of all of them. He was probably the most athletic, but like I realised just how ridiculously hard that is. So I think back myself on a wild boar, maybe yeah. Could upgrade after that.
Strong. Profession-wise?
Yeah.
a medical man.
Yeah, medical man. All around a medical del boy. I'd say it's probably equally as... like complex as my where I'm from, really, because I started as a doctor. It's actually 10 years this summer since I graduated medicine from Cardiff. Then I went into surgery and I decided that I...
Here we go. Shall we quickly caveat that there's some fucking drilling going on outside? So if you can hear that, we apologise. Yeah. But we're going to just crack on.
Yeah, exactly. We had a board meeting about whether to do this yeah. or not, or postpone. But graduated medicine. At the time, didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. But quite quickly, the first rotation that I was on working as a junior doctor was in surgery. And I fell in love with it. Just loved the fast pace of it. The fact that you get a problem. Usually, hopefully, you'll do an operation, you'll fix it, and you'll send them home fixed, right? It's not always the case, obviously. But I loved that, like, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, sort of approach to it.
And medical terminology.
Yeah, yeah, forgive me if I'm getting too technical. But then it's just a case of, depending on how you slice it, there are probably about 14 surgical specialties. And it was just a case of systematically going through all of them. And then I came across something called maxillofacial surgery, which is all surgery, face and mouth, head and neck sort of thing. And I just loved it. And it's a bit like how people describe when they meet their wife-to-be for the first time. It's like, when you know, I just... loved it, and I just loved everything about the surgery, the people, the kind of patients that you see. But the thing was that you have to have degrees in both medicine and dentistry to go into that specialty.
Okay.
So then I went and did a 3-year dental degree at King's, which finished around the time of the pandemic. So then, because I didn't have my I wasn't a surgical specialist at that stage, the best way I could help in the pandemic was to go back and help in A&E as a doctor. And at that point, because, you know, it was either work or being at home, I started a business Which was helping people get into medical school, because I had been doing that for a long time and kind of just turned it into what was originally an online course. But then it's evolved to basically take over my life now.
Nice.
And now 90%, 80% maybe of my working week is spent on that company, which is called Future Doc.
Nice little plug.
Yeah.
So you still work for the NHS 10%-ish of your time, or are you purely focused on your own thing?
So now I'm on like, I'm what you'd call a locum. Yeah. And so I have a 0 hours contract. So I was doing quite regular shifts, but now I actually do my own like private clinic, cool. Which I started doing around the time we were coming out of the pandemic. So I do a lot of that. I do the occasional bit of work still with the NHS. And yeah, like I say, like it's that thing of, when you find something that you really enjoy, it doesn't feel like work because, you know, people sound ridiculous when they say, oh, I do 16 hours a day on it. But I do wake up, do some work on the business, then go off and do stuff.
Yeah.
Then, but like throughout the day, up until the time I go to bed, I'm constantly doing little bits. Yeah. So
cumulatively, you're probably working. It's like 16 hours a day or whatever that might be.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like it? Or
yeah, exactly. It doesn't feel like... but. To say I work 16 hours a day would be a lie, but it would be like I'll do 2 intense hours, then I'll go to the gym, and then I'll like, you know, take a long lunch, but maybe I'll sit with my laptop doing something while I'm watching TV. So it's really, it becomes kind of, I think a lot of people who are really engrossed in a project, or maybe entrepreneurs or other people who like, what they do is such an inherent part of their life. The lines get blurred between work and regular life, and that can be a good thing, that can be a bad thing. Like anything, anything good to its excess becomes a bad thing. So, yeah. But it seems to mesh quite well.
Nice.
My girlfriend hasn't kicked me out yet. So,
most importantly, what was Cardiff like for a night out?
Amazing.
Yeah,
Cardiff is a fantastic city. The only thing I underestimated is. Being English in Wales is a lot, like you probably found it in Scotland, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like it is something that you will get pointed out, and yeah, especially when the rugby's on, you will get the shit ripped out of you, especially if Wales win. And if England win, you don't get to give it back, you just have to keep your head down. But no, Cardiff's an amazing city. Like I was saying, in my business, I'm always helping students decide what universities to go for. And I always say that Cardiff's a lovely, like, in-between university in that going to a campus uni, you're very much in a bubble.
Yeah.
And, I mean, nothing against it. Like, people absolutely love that. But you're very, like, uni is your identity.
Yeah.
Whereas then, you know, I said I studied at King's for the dentistry in London.
Is that when you moved to London?
No, it was actually...
You were there already?
No, it was a year before I started there.
Okay.
I moved to London. But when I did that degree... You know, you're a London, you when you study in London, you are basically, you're just another Londoner, and what you do happens to be being a student, if you see what I mean.
100%.
The other thing is where you are a student and that is your identity.
Yeah, so I went to Stirling Uni, Campus Uni, you're not a Stirlinger, as in someone who lives in the city, you're a student who studies in Stirling, whereas in London, it's the other way around, right? So you live in London and happen to be a student.
Yeah. And I always say Cardiff's like that beautiful in-between of, it's a great city, loads going on, but it's compact enough to really be manageable. You can walk from one end to the other in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's got like that real student vibe, but also just everything that you'd want of a reasonable size city. So I always found it was the best of both. And have you been to Cardiff?
I have never been to Cardiff. I've been to Swansea a couple of times.
I think Cardiff's very unique for a night out because, firstly...
What's the big night? Wednesdays?
Mate, every night...
At uni, I was going to say Tuesday.
Tuesday used to be the big night, and it was funny because all the sports teams would go mad because it was the best night of the week, and obviously sports was on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So everyone would be livid that people would be out on the, you know, double vodka Red Bulls until the early hours. But the thing about Cardiff nightlife that I was going to say is that it's all basically on two streets.
Okay.
And you'll never go wrong because... You'll go out, and if one place is crap, you just go to the next. And you'll all, because of that nature, you'll just always bump into people you know. It's just always fun. And the thing about it is, the stadium, if you're going to watch the rugby, I honestly don't think there's a city like it. For the stadium is literally in the middle of all the bars, like because it's just, you take the city centre and the most vibrant part, and they've literally just stuck a stadium right next to it. So it's
such a good shout.
Yeah, if you watch like videos of the Rugby World Cup from when it was in, was it 2015 in England. England and slash Wales,
but mainly
I gotta get that in. But there are videos of people from all over the world being like, this is amazing, like you know, loads of bars before the, you know, just can go out in loads of bars, just literally a stone's throw away from the stadium, and they were just like losing their minds about how much fun it was and how great a setup it was.
This is making me very thirsty. So if we move swiftly on, so doctor, medicine, NHS, what were some of the challenges that you faced or still face kind of working for them?
Yeah.
Because obviously the NHS feels like on the outside, it's going through a bit of a challenging moment.
Yeah, yeah. And to kind of put it in context, we, what are we, a few weeks after the first strikes of 2023, where, you know, people are protesting about pay. I think the thing I would say is, you, when you sign up to be a doctor, you put your trust in a system that is going to train you, provide you with a meaningful career, you know, pay you, support you, give you fulfillment, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you speak to older consultants, they had a very different experience to what we have. They were working more hours, for sure, but they were, I think the rewards were slightly better for them. And this is me saying this, you know, I could sound very idealistic saying this. So I'm sure older consultants will probably pick holes in something that, that I'm saying, but there was a very
big... I'm sure they're listening.
Yeah, exactly. All your consultants out there. But there's a big camaraderie around it because you were all there, but you were basically kind of all living in the hospital together at the same time. And yes, okay, you didn't have as much of a life, but it was kind of your, like, the development and growth that you'd get because you were there all the time would be greater, and also you'd have loads of mates that were in it together.
Yeah.
And the thing that I hear a lot of older consultants say is that it was more fun back then.
Yes.
And obviously that's not the only thing that you search for in a career.
No, but it is a big thing, yeah.
But I think the thing that, you know, sometimes people vote with their feet, and the fact that I am, you know, naturally leaning towards more working on a business rather than being in a training program is that I think the system has let people down in the sense that you have very little control over your time, and you're not, I don't think many people would argue that you're not remunerated fairly for what you do, because, you know, out of these strikes, there have been a lot of comparisons of like a prêt-à-manger, I think it's a manager. Someone not particularly high up in prêt-à-manger gets £14.10 an hour. Mm-hmm. Junior doctor, it works out, gets £14.09 an hour. And when you think, it's not just the work that you're doing, it's the sacrifice, the 6 years of study for some people. It's dozens of grand worth of debt that you get. And there's a lot that goes into it, and, you know, you give up a lot, you miss loads of important events, and, you know, and what you're doing, there's no arguing that it is important.
Yeah.
And I think to then say, well, actually, you know, we don't feel appreciated, and because of that, people are leaving, and then it's a vicious cycle of, well, actually, I'm having to work even harder now because we're not replacing the workforce because we're not paying them what people think is fair.
Yeah.
And then again, that's another thing, people voting with their feet. They're going off to Canada, to New Zealand, to Australia.
So it almost feels like back in the day, the work enjoyment, the camaraderie, even the altruistic nature of it, the fulfillment, outweighed the sacrifices and the costs that came with being a doctor. However, now, maybe more the balance has shifted, and it's not that well, as well, like, paid. You don't get the sense of camaraderie, it's not as fun. And therefore, the benefits that you get from doing the job aren't as big, and therefore don't justify the costs required to do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, at the end of the day, you know, people are people. They've got goodwill and they want to do something helpful, but only to the point, People don't want to get the piss taken out of them.
Yeah, of course.
And as much as I want to do well, you know, people don't realise as well the costs of being a doctor. Like, you, for example, in a couple of years, as in when you're trying to, say, go into surgery, you have to do up to, you know, a number of exams, sometimes two, maybe more, like, and so it's 500 quid for the first exam, it's a grand for the second exam, 33% pass rate, so in theory you might have to do that three times, maybe sometimes even more. You have to do courses to get through it, which basically cost the amount of the fee, and you pay the fee every time you sit the exam, so if you fail it you have to pay again. And that's just to progress your career. You've got your insurance, you've got your GMC license, you've got so many things to pay that people look at your pay and they think, oh, that's it, but there's so much that comes with it that people don't really understand. I think
the unpredictable nature of the hours is something that I personally just couldn't do, the different shifts. I'm like a structured man of routine, you know, and I just don't, you know. So for example, George, who we train with, he is a paramedic. And he comes into the morning sessions after having done a full night shift, and he looks absolutely fucked. I'm like, mate, how, like, unbelievable respect to him, but I'm like, how can you do that? I just like need my more structured Monday to Friday life, and I'm just like happy with that.
Did he smash you when he was like that, or was
no one actually? Yeah.
For the benefits of the podcast, how he's undefeated. He's never actually lost a
never
round.
Tapped jiu-jitsu,
while we're there, yeah, go on.
When did you start, why did you start, and what sort of impact has it had on your life?
So I started probably, I think it was September, 2021. And I think off the back of, there's a thing called turnover shock, which is whenever you have a period of your life to reflect. It's like usually like after marriage or a death, but for everybody, the world had COVID to like reflect. So they call that turnover shock, but the world had a big, unanimous, coordinated turnover shock. So lots of people were changing their lives. And it was just one thing that, you know, I did kickboxing when I was in school and really enjoyed it and competed a little bit. And I was like, I want to go into something that's going to give me that discipline. So I literally just Googled what's the best martial art. And the first video that comes up, I'm a big Tim Ferriss fan, so I was familiar with Jocko Willink. The first video that comes up is Jocko Willink talking about which is the best martial art. And he says, the best self-defense, firstly, is a gun. I think, I don't know if he says the one, the second bit is a pair of running shoes. But
I dare anyone to listen to Jocko for more than 5 minutes and not start jiu-jitsu.
Or like Rogan. I listened to a recent episode with
Russell Brand,
and
great episode.
Yeah, and it's
great episode.
Russell Brand is so eloquent. The way he talks about jiu-jitsu, I was like, yes. And then Rogan was saying how important the purple belt is.
Yes.
Did you hear that bit where he's saying like, it's kind of like your black belt, you just need to put the reps in. Yeah. You know the basics.
It's the big milestone belt between being a beginner, I would say, and then actually being pretty competent.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I guess we'll touch on that thing we were talking about before we recorded about the finite and infinite games and why people leave and all that sort of stuff. But so that's what got me into it. What I get out of it, and it's funny because I feel like there's loads of similarities between jiu-jitsu and medicine. Because the first year of jiu-jitsu, just like medicine, it's like you're learning all these bits. It's kind of overwhelming. You can't take it all in. It's all disparate little bits apart. That eventually you start, after a while, it starts clicking and you start joining the dots a little bit and it starts to make sense. And I think it's gone in stages for me, because I think the first couple of weeks of jiu-jitsu, I was like, I'm not sure if I actually like this. I don't know. I'm kind of coming and I'm just doing the moves and I'm like, I don't know how I feel about it.
It's so weird. You're like, why am I sat between someone's legs? Essentially coming in.
Straddling
strangers. Yeah, this isn't what I signed up to. Yeah. But I kind of like it now.
Yeah. So after a couple of weeks, something clicked. I was like, fuck yeah, I love this.
Mm.
But then it's actually only after maybe another 6 months that you start getting okay at, well, being able to spar.
It starts to make sense all the because you learn it positionally, right? So you learn individual positions, and at the beginning, you're like, wow, what? How on earth does this all fit together? But then when you see how those individual components do start to fit together and you can build your own game around those different positions and start to spar, as you say, that's when you're like, ah, here we go.
Yeah, totally. And that's where I say it's like medicine, because it's like eventually things start to, the dots start to connect, and then it's kind of like, every time you pass a certain skill or a certain subject area, your knowledge gets deeper, and then you go and then you do another pass and it goes deeper. And it's kind of like, it's the same with medicine, is that like you, there's no end to it. You can just keep going deeper and deeper. Every time you learn a little detail more, you just deepen your knowledge, or there's something new. And it just, it's like that, I guess that spiral of, it's like going, it's always going.
Yeah.
And this is what we were talking about with like finite and infinite games, is that there
is... Do you want to quickly explain the difference between the two?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a book by James Cast, and it's basically, it was, he came up with the idea when he was watching his kids play, and he said that some games are there with a clear endpoint that are designed to kind of be done and finish with and you move on. Mm. Whereas some games are infinite, that the aim is just to keep the game going for as long as possible. And you can apply that to different areas of life, in that some people will see jiu-jitsu as a finite game. Like, I just want to get my blue belt, or I just want to get my black belt and then I'm done. Versus looking at that as an infinite game, is that I'm just here to keep going, keep improving. I'm not going to stop. There's no like, oh, I'm going to get to here and then I'm done. And that, I think, it depends like how you apply that theory to different areas of life.
Yeah.
But I think applying the right side of the coin in the right way can really change the way that you look at it.
Because there's no right or wrong way to approach it. And actually, the finite games can be amazingly beneficial for your short-term motivation. Like, we've all been there, right? Oh, shit, I've got a holiday. Beach holiday in 6 weeks, boom, that gives you like motivation to you know, go to the gym and stuff.
Crash diet.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously having, you know, I don't know, to use exercise again, or even at work, a promotion in the kind of short term future to work towards can give you more, you know, motivation and something to work towards. However, I would argue that the infinite games is probably in the long term a healthier game to play, I suppose, because it comes with a lack of pressure, because you're just doing it for the love of doing it, as opposed to doing it for a specific goal, you know? Yeah. And like, for example, go back to jiu-jitsu. If you're like, right, I want to get my blue belt and then quit, I can imagine that every time you get tapped out, that's going to hurt you way more, hurt your ego way more than if you're just doing it for the love of doing it, because you just know. Because on the one hand, it seems like a setback. If it's a finite game, whereas it's an infinite game, you're like, well, that's just all part of the process, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And I think we were talking about this earlier, that like the waves of up and down of jiu-jitsu, and especially like after getting my blue belt, I think some people, the classic thing when people get their blue belt is, oh, it's a target on your back. Like, everyone's gunning. Everyone wants to beat the blue belt. All the white belts want to submit the blue belt. And it's a weird, like, for me, I find it quite motivating. So I was like, shit, I really need to deserve this now. And it actually, I thought it would scare me off, and it actually motivated me on. But then you go through waves of, like, you have a couple of bad days and you get submitted by people and you think, oh, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
And, like, it's a bit embarrassing sometimes. And that can, I can imagine that mentality trickling, like kind of insidiously going, like permeating your mindset towards it, and eventually being the reason people quit.
Mm.
But it, like you say, you just, if you have that attitude of like, I'm just going to keep going and see what happens, and hopefully, you know, I'll try my best, I'll turn up, I'll be present and try and keep learning. And then, you know, eventually it turns around and you start doing well and you're like, oh, okay.
I've got this a bit. Jiu-jitsu is very analogous to loads of other areas in life in terms of day in, day out, you don't really feel the improvements. And a lot of time you're like, my God, I'm not getting anywhere with this. But if you just keep turning up, you will eventually get better. And if you assess yourself over a long enough period, you know, compare where we were, you know, 6 months ago, it's night and day. But I think why a lot of people quit it in comparison to, let's say, weight training or running, is if you have a running goal that in a year you want to be able to run a half marathon or a marathon, you can, I don't want to say easily, but that's very, very achievable. You can become a good runner in a year, 100%. You can't become good at jiu-jitsu in a year.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the, just the slow nature of improvement is one of the frustrating things about it for a lot of people, but also one of the quite, in want of a better word, beautiful things about it as well, because I think it just really develops your ability just to commit to something, even though you don't see vast improvements.
Totally. You know, one of the biggest lessons I learned from medicine was, I call it like A-level thinking or GCSE thinking, where when I sat those exams as a kid, I just smashed out. I was like, you know, terrible at school. Not terrible, but I was lazy and fucked around and, you know, just joking around the whole time. But then for like that 3 month period in year 11, I absolutely nailed this, hit the books, studied really hard. And in that 3 month period, I kind of learned the syllabus, did well enough to get good grades. And then you forgot about it. And it's that thing of like, if you work hard for something, you can just complete it, and then you've completed it and you can forget about it. And that I applied to medicine, and I came unstuck in my first year because I was just like, oh, I've just got to complete. Well, it wasn't even in my first year. It was more actually kind of throughout the degree. It was actually only towards the end of the degree that I learned that it's like, you can't just aim to complete something, tick it off, something like that.
Finite game.
Yeah, exactly. So you can't treat that as a finite game. If you try and tick it off and be like, okay, I'm done with that now, I can forget about it, move on, you'll get stuck, you'll get caught out, because it's not something that, it's something that needs renewal and it's constant. And yeah, it's...
You notice that at jiu-jitsu when you take like a week or so away from the mats. So I was obviously on holiday last weekend, I was off for a week, came back on Thursday, you come back and you're like, my God, I feel absolutely useless at this.
Yeah.
Even worse than usual.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? That those long holidays can be the death of so many things.
Mate.
Piano. I used to play piano and I used to love it. And I was so dedicated to it for four or five years. I'd play every day. And then my 30th birthday, I went away with my girlfriend. And then I came back and went home to Birmingham to see the family. And by the time it was about 3 weeks of not playing piano at all, never touched it again.
Like, and you've not played it since?
Not played it since. Like, maybe I've tried for a session, one or two, but that's 5 years ago. And it's mad how that little break, that little extended break, can be the death of something that you were so committed.
Breaker. Yeah. What are you like on holiday? Because obviously
I think you're on piano. I was like, please don't whip out any keyboard and ask me to play anything because I can't remember one song.
What? Because you know you're someone who's pretty ambitious, hardworking, disciplined. What are you like on holiday? Can you switch off, or do you find that difficult?
Oh, it depends. So, my favourite thing, like I'm lucky that my grandparents have this place in like coastal Spain that
whereabouts?
So it's just on
Marbs,
yeah, that's it. Now so it's halfway between Valencia and Alicante. So really nice. Just
muy bien.
Yeah. And you go and just do nothing. And it's amazing because it's a flat just opposite the beach. There's just some nice little restaurants around, and I can sit and do fuck all for, can I swear?
Yeah. No, what are you doing? Yeah, of course.
edit. And just sit and relax. And like, I think that is really important to have that time where you're just doing absolutely nothing, just
recharge the batteries, right?
Yeah. And you know, we're talking about burnout before, or like people striking at the moment because burnout is high. That you need that time to do absolutely nothing and recharge, so that you can just find that energy to go again. Because for me, it's a series of sprints.
Yeah,
it's like you know, New Year's obviously. So we're coming to the end of March now. New Year was the latest sprint, and I'm good for, you know, maybe 6 weeks. I can really churn out like good productivity, getting shit done with my business, like really on it. But I've noticed the last month, I've just kind of, as much as I'm trying, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm starting to flag a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm going away for a week. So my girlfriend's South African, so we're going to see her family in South Africa. I've never been before, so I'm really excited.
Right.
Yeah. So, what about y'all? So I'm really, really excited for that. But I'm really excited for the, like, long bit of recharge that I'll get, and the energy and inspiration and stuff that I'll have to come back to do the next sprint.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's where I make my progress.
Nice.
I don't know if it's because you know something's coming. Yeah. You know a break's coming that you feel like I really need it, or I actually do genuinely need it, and it's come at a good time. I can never tell with that.
Yeah.
It's the psychology of it, but...
Yeah, it's interesting. Is burnout something you've suffered from in the past?
I think so, yeah.
Is it something that... Because basically the nature of a sprint is that it's unsustainable, right?
Mm.
So it's almost the recipe to get burnt out. But it seems like you're more self-aware now to know how long you can sprint for before you kind of need to recharge.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, you know what? It's only something that I've become aware of in the last couple of weeks. I think I was listening to Jordan Peterson, and he said, like, yeah, some days I can write for 4 hours, some days I can write for 6 hours, or whatever his numbers were. But he's like, but if I write for 6 hours, then the next 2 days I'll basically not write at all. So he's like, he's like very aware of what his limit is.
Work capacity. And
although he could go beyond it, he chooses not to because he realizes that it's going to be, it's like having a bad night's sleep. You can do it, but you'll pay for it the next 2 days. So I've only recently become aware of, like, what is the, like, the baseline for me and what I can sustain. But yeah, definitely I've burnt out so many times. Probably the biggest one was when I did the dental degree. So going back to uni, so I was 2016. So I was 3 years out of studying medicine. So I'd done 2 years as a foundation doctor, so a junior doctor. I don't know. Do you understand the difference between like junior doctors and consultants? Because that's a lot of confusion.
My sister and her husband are both doctors.
Oh, there you go.
So well aware.
Yeah. So for people that don't understand, so junior doctors is basically anyone who's finished medicine, so finished their degree and is training to be a consultant, but you're still, you know, doing all the regular stuff for doctors. The thing that people think that because you're training, that it means that you're not practicing as a doctor, that you're a medical student. But actually, you know, it could be over a decade of work. And especially when you're a senior registrar, which is still a junior doctor, they're doing a lot. They're making most of the decisions and only referring the really difficult cases to the consultants for an opinion. So, yeah, that's one thing that's been a bit of a muddle in the media lately, is what a junior doctor is. But anyway, that's an aside, just to clear that in the midst of all the junior doctor strikes and people misunderstanding that. But yeah, so foundation medicine, so the first 2 years of working fully as a doctor. Then I did a year of locuming, which is kind of zero hours contracts, but I ended up probably doing more than I would normally.
Yeah.
And then I went into this 3 year dental degree, which is condensing a 5 year degree into 3 years. Ooh. So that was already very intense. I was living in London, which was a bit of a shock in terms of the expense of things and the rent and all that sort of stuff. Not only that, I had to fund the course and fund a mortgage. So basically, you know, it's a 9 to 5 degree, Monday to Friday. cramming in 5 years into three, then in London, and I have to like basically work outside of that to sustain all of that. So I was going, like, you know, at times I was going to the dental, to university, going, doing a night shift, then going back to dentistry the next morning.
Yeah.
And it's just like ridiculous, incredibly unsustainable, but it was just what you had to do to get there.
It's funny because unsustainable is the word, right? Yeah. But I actually do think there is benefit, especially when you're younger, in terms of working unsustainably hard, because you almost find your maximum work capacity and then you can kind of work back from there.
Yeah.
And that's going to be different for everyone, you know, whether it's you can work, you know, 6 hours a day, 12 hours a day, 18 hours a day, whatever it is. But then you can find that out and that gives you a bit of a yardstick that you can just use in life in general. Going back to your point about Jordan Peterson, he knows he can work for X hours a day before he needs to rein it in.
Mm.
So I think you can only ever find that out by actually working unsustainable and seeing where your breaking point is. I mean, it sounds unhealthy, but I think it can be long term.
It's tinkering, right? Bit. You just, you try different things, you measure them, you see how you feel, and then you eventually find what works. But it's like in the gym, you do your one rep max, right? And you keep going until you can't do anymore. Yeah. And then that, you
gives know, you
like
baseline.
Said, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know everything that you can do, like from that one rep max, you can know what your five rep max should be and all that sort of thing. Is
What did burnout look like for you? How did it manifest? Was it a case of literally couldn't leave bed? A sense of depression, you know, hopelessness? How bad did it get?
I get, when I'm really burnt out, I end up in this like horrible, no sleep, high caffeine, like buzz. And what I find is that I'd, like, if it would be a big event, like say it's a social event, I'd not be quite on form. You wouldn't really have that like presence when you interact with people. You can't be as quick-witted. But also the thing is that I'd feel like I needed loads of like a big coffee or just, you know, just before I went out, and that gave me quite bad anxiety, and that manifested for me as like sweating a lot. And yeah, I noticed it, and actually it became quite a problem for a while. And it's almost like, that's the thing with burnout, is that you have all these symptoms that you don't necessarily, can't necessarily relate them to that. It's really hard to attribute a cause to them.
Mm.
I think, so like, you know, they did, going back to burnout and doctors, they did a survey last year, well, they do it every year, the GMC well-being survey, and they ask 7 questions about burnout and, you know, do you feel exhausted? Are you frustrated? Do you feel like you have no energy at the end of work? And blah, blah, blah. And a lot of the time, the symptoms of burnout, like you say, they don't, because it's a bit like a dental cavity, it's like long-term stress.
Mm.
It's hard to pinpoint exactly where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So people don't necessarily go, oh, I'm feeling all these things, I must be burnt out.
Yeah.
They might be like, oh, maybe I've got a virus today, or maybe I'm just a bit, whatever, tired or whatever it is. So, it's always difficult to pinpoint exactly where it's coming from.
Mm.
But it's only when you get that rest and you kind of come out of it that you can see what it was like. So I think you almost, like, it's a bit like what you're saying about finding your limits. You almost have to go through the shit sometimes to come out and go, oh, actually, I can see what led me to get there and avoid going there again, if you can.
It's funny because what is burnout, right? Burnout is essentially what working excessively to exhaustion. You don't want to almost, and therefore like hard work is a natural component of that, but you don't want to throw the hard work baby out with the burnout bathwater.
Yeah.
Because, and I can only ever speak for myself, right? But what I found is that hard work and I suppose working hard towards difficult things has been for me probably the single most beneficial thing for my overall mental health, I think, because I think I'm someone who is naturally, I think, quite lazy. Mm. I always got by for the first 25-ish years
yeah.
of my life by doing the absolute bare minimum. I think I kind of naturally had quite a low sense of self-esteem, and I had a lot of insecurities and a lot of self-doubt. And I think that by committing to doing difficult things and overcoming and achieving those difficult things, mm. that the accumulation of those difficult things over time is you almost literally develop or have a range of evidence showing, proving to yourself that you're not a totally fucking useless human,
mm.
right? And that, I think, for me, has been the most beneficial things in terms of eradicating some of those feelings of self-doubt. So I do think, that obviously burnout's not great, but we don't want to throw, as I say, that kind of hard work baby out with the burnout bathwater, because I do think it is like a crucial component for people's overall happiness and sense of fulfillment.
Yeah, totally. And when I say agreed, I mean I was the same. I was also very lazy and I naturally just want to sit and eat loads of dairy milk and watch Friends reruns, but sometimes eventually the guilt catches up with me. Mm. But I guess the age-old question that you hear a lot of people, especially in the self-development world, say is that thing of like, at what point should I just be happy with my lot and be, you know, content and just generally like be grateful? And at what point should I try and improve my situation? And
it's the, so difficult.
Yeah, and it's the Western philosophy of, you know, constant refinement and making yourself a better person versus Eastern philosophy, which is be present, be content,
acceptance.
Be grateful. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, so I read a really great book. Oh, it's called Free Now, I believe, by the author will come to me. But he talks about, he's a psychiatrist, I believe, and he talks about in his practice how he marries the two. I think he's actually a psychologist, and how he marries the two. And it's a bit like that finite and infinite games thing where you apply different thinking to different areas.
Mm.
And the kind of adaptation I have of those things now is that I try and apply Eastern philosophy on the whole and then Western philosophy in chunks. So okay. In the spring, I'll have that kind of like, right, here's my goal, here's what I'm trying to do, or here's this thing about myself I'm trying to improve, here's whatever I'm trying to reach. But in the long term, understand that, you know, really, I'm very lucky, I'm very happy, and I try and be as grateful as I can and take the time to reflect on that. But yeah, within that, it'd be great to...
Mate, it's such a difficult balance to get, because going back to jiu-jitsu, I find a direct correlation between if I'm feeling pretty happy and content, my motivation to go to the gym or to go to jiu-jitsu and literally like fight other people essentially is basically zero, because I almost feel too content to do that.
Mm.
Whereas if I've got a bit of, if I've got a bit of fuel, whether that's some
bit
sort
of the devil in you,
you know, yeah, whatever that is, then that actually gives me a bit of drive to go out and, you know, train jiu-jitsu, go to the gym, do this sort of podcast, work on a blog, whatever that might be. So it's such a difficult balance to get between almost trying as much as you can to be content within yourself, but also not at the detriment to your, I suppose, motivation to go out and work hard and commit to doing various things, you know. And that's an ongoing balance that I think I really struggle with.
Yeah, and I think, like you say, it is a balance, and the pendulum swings both sides of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you feel like you've got it about right. Sometimes, you know, I think it's that thing of, again, I just want, in fact, one book that I read, and actually he's just had a documentary released, Phil Stutz, and it's called Stutz. And he talks, It's like this thing of like...
Very imaginative name for a documentary.
Oh, it's great. It's Jonah. So it's Jonah Hill, the Hollywood actor. He was in a really bad place and he went to see... He'd seen loads of therapists and then he came across Phil Sturz, who, funnily enough, I'd been reading his books for a couple of years. Again, heard from the Tim Ferriss show. So he'd seen all these therapists and finally Phil Sturz was the guy that kind of sorted him out. Mm. And one of the big things from his books and from the documentary, which I'd highly recommend to anybody, is this thing of like...
What, is it on Netflix?
Netflix,
or is
yeah.
It, yeah.
It's like, you're never done. It's like, yeah. There's this thing that people... And again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's like, there's this feeling that you are going to do a certain amount of work and then you can relax. You're done for life. You can check out. You can retire almost from having to make effort. Yeah. And one of the big realizations... for when my business started actually doing all right and, you know, all these things. And again, like the attitude that I try and carry forward to jiu-jitsu is like, you're never done. The need for constant work is always there. You can't just suddenly...
Mate, it's that classic trap that we all fall into. It's those four or five words, I'll be happy when.
Yeah, totally.
And when I get a promotion, when I run that marathon... when I get married, whatever
get
it is.
Blue belt.
Yeah. And you get that momentary boost of happiness. But, you know, a few hours, couple of days, whatever it is later, yeah. You just revert back to your baseline level.
Yeah.
And it's just a ongoing thing. And that's why I think, going back to what we're saying about finite, infinite games, which is something you literally told me about today, and I really like that concept, is that it almost encourages you more to just try as much as you can to do things for the love of doing them, as opposed to being overly goal-focused. And as we're saying, goals can be beneficial. They can give you that motivation. But in the long term, the most... I found that the best way of committing to something sustainably is to try and just get enjoyment from doing the thing itself,
yeah.
as opposed to doing the thing for a specific reason.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's not about being curious, isn't it? It's like, do you want to learn a language because you want to tick it off and have that on your CV?
Yeah.
Or do you want to learn a language because you've got, you know, it's like a cool thing to learn. Maybe you've got something. I mean, I suppose having something coming up that would make you want to learn languages, more goal setting wise, but is it more of a curiosity thing and just another cool thing to explore, right? And I think the attitude that you take into... either of those, depending on which way you approach it, is very different. And I find that they're like, oh, this is cool, let's see where this takes me, sort of thing, is usually a bit more of a fun way to do it. I do accumulate a lot of hobbies, so.
But I think that is, again, and probably boring everyone with all the references to jiu-jitsu, but that probably, in a nutshell, is one of, if not the biggest beauties of jiu-jitsu, is that it just... you need to take enjoyment out of purely doing it, because it's such a slow process to get any good at it. You know, so that it's basically ballpark based on how consistently you train, but it's basically 2-ish years per belt, right? And therefore those goals are kind of in the longer term, so you just to continue doing it, you just need to enjoy it in the short term. And I think that principle can be applied, to your point, to all areas of life.
And you're a big fan of James Clear, aren't you, the Atomic Habits guy?
That, so you know when you read a book that just a game changer in terms of your outlook in life, for me that's like top three. That's a top tier book, Atomic Habits. I couldn't recommend it enough. It's so easy to read, and it's full of like actionable things. It's great.
He's just a very intelligent guy in the way that he's approached everything. But the thing that stuck with me most from that is that thing of like, you, when you're in a plateau, don't see it as like, oh, I'm not improving. He's just like, you're just loading the bases for something good to happen soon. And that is definitely a thing that I've started thinking now, especially again, to go back to jiu-jitsu, when you have like a shit month. Like, you can have a shit month where you're I've barely done anything. I've barely submitted people. I've barely done blah, blah, blah. And then, but like now, before I'd have just been like, oh, I'm not getting any better. So maybe years ago, I'd have probably quit in that circumstance. But now I'm just like, no, you just clocking in the hours, you know, filling up the VAT or whatever you want to call it.
Getting the reps in.
You're getting the reps in to eventually that's going to level you up to the next level. And then you'll kind of hit another plateau and you just have to accept that.
Yeah. And I love his idea that whether you're a success or a failure is just dependent on when you assess that thing. So, for example, you know, if you judged James Clear's life by his own admission on whether it was successful or a failure before he'd published Atomic Habits, you'd be like, well, he's just a failed author. And then now you're like, well, he's one of the most successful non-fiction writers in the planet. And I think that's another thing that can be applicable to any area of life. Career-wise, it can be sometimes frustrating if you don't feel like you're progressing as quickly as you can. But you're only judging that based on today's context.
Mm.
You know, look back in 5 years and it might be a different story. So that's why I think it's really important not to assess life necessarily where you are right now, but more the trajectory that you're
on. Yeah, the time frame means everything. It's that classic thing of like people underestimate what they can do in a year. No, other way around, it was right the first time. They overestimate what they can achieve in a year, underestimate what they can achieve in a decade.
Mm.
So people think too short term sometimes.
Love it. And in a decade, that belt around our waist will be...
There you go. Hopefully black. Hopefully black.
Don't know about that.
With a few stripes on it, maybe.
Should we look to wrap this up?
Yeah. I had one question I wanted to ask you to flip it on you.
No. I asked the question, so...
Yeah. I'm in charge. So I love the fact that you're doing a podcast. Mm. And it's always something that I've thought, oh, it'd be really awesome to do that. And I've never quite
found
something.
I don't need the competition. I'm going to put
you
off.
But I think I love the thing of like always understanding why people do stuff.
Mm.
So probably to put you on the spot, because I haven't asked you this before outside of this, but why do you do it?
Many reasons. Both probably intrinsic and extrinsic. Firstly, I enjoy doing it.
Mm.
I enjoy just chatting to people, mm-hmm. to be honest. Secondly, I work in the communications industry, right? So advertising, marketing, and therefore your kind of verbal and written communications is such an important part of the role. And naturally, I think I'm relatively talented at writing, but speaking, I'm fucking terrible. I'm so like clunky and umy and ahry. And unless I'm like very well prepared, giving like a speech or presentation on the spot, I'm infinitely better now, but naturally just dog shit. So to be honest, it was also part of the reason to do this, to kind of almost keep me accountable and then hopefully over time get better at it. And to be honest, third kind of like intrinsic reason is that I think it fills a bit of a meaning gap in my life, not to get too deep, but I realized late 20s, I kind of just lived a fun hedonistic type of life.
Mm-hmm.
But then after a while, you're like, geez, I have literally nothing to show for this. And you just feel a bit down and a bit meh about life, right? And you're like, right, I need to try and do something to just make myself feel a little bit better. And to be honest, rightly, wrongly, it just, for me, doing this podcast, writing the blog, gives me some sort of sense of fulfillment. So that's another reason why I do it. And to be honest, extrinsically, if people can take anything remotely, however minimal, positively from it, you know, whether, I don't know, they find it, yeah, again, like remotely interesting or even if they can, I don't know, learn something or see something from a different point of view, then I'd like to think that that's, yeah, hopefully a positive thing. And if it, again, does my tiny little bit to try and encourage people to have more of an open conversation about these topics, then again, I suppose that ties in with the meaning point, then hopefully that's a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah. Well, no, it's cool. Like, I mean, since you told me about this, I've listened to a few episodes and it's really interesting. And I think with regards to, like, just on a kind of initial base level, there's things that you get from it. Definitely your ability to speak well. And I think you're actually really, I actually used to think before I knew that you did the podcast that you speak very eloquently and you make your points very clearly.
Thanks. I'm going to clip that.
Yeah, yeah.
On my Instagram.
You're welcome. But it is that, because it, for my business, I do a lot of filming and a lot of teaching live seminars and all that sort of stuff. And the ability to formulate your ideas verbally massively improves. I think that's a huge thing. Same with your writing. I imagine your writing now compared to when you first started, you know, night and day.
By the way, writing is a game changer for speaking as well, because you just realize that you can almost formulate your ideas, put some structure behind them. Yeah. And the best way to speak better is just by practice, right? That's basically like anything. But I think practicing writing definitely does, those skills do transfer into being able to articulate yourself better. So it's something I'd just highly recommend anyone.
Clarifying your thoughts, whether it's an, like a point you want to, like an idea that you want to develop or a feeling that you want to digest. Like, I wish I wrote more, because I think it's such an important, it's like the ultimate self-therapy, really, a lot of people say.
Don't they? Yeah. You just get shit out of your head and onto paper. It's very therapeutic to do.
Really cathartic. So, so that, like, externally, so the reason I ask is because, like I say, because firstly, I really admire it. It's something I thought about doing myself, but I also can see externally the skills that you gain. So, you know, being able to speak well, I think it's an amazing way to have people that you, we probably wouldn't have had the depth of conversation that we've had about things and in the run up to it, like maybe discussing things that we might talk
quite
about.
Quite literally the run up.
Yeah.
Went for a cheeky little jog this morning.
It's a good way to get ready for it. But I think, so it's also like getting to know people better through it, I would say.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, you know, when this goes to the stratosphere, but I look at people like, you know, Stephen Bartlett and your guy that you like, Chris Williamson.
Yeah.
Like the amount of people that you then almost surround yourself with by doing a podcast and getting to have these amazing conversations and learn really cool things from these people. These are all very selfish reasons, I realise.
Yeah, but no, but
The way I'd be thinking about it, I'd probably see more of the selfish benefits, if I'm honest. But then, obviously, from that, your conversations, you know, chances are if you're thinking something, somebody else is thinking it. Or if you've been through something, you know, although we're very unique individuals, the experiences do translate a lot to other people. So,
but I think that's also one of the big causes, or one of the big issues with like depressive feelings, is that you can get in your own head and you can think no one understands what I'm going through, which is quite a lonely, alienating thing to think, when actually if you kind of step out your own head, you realize actually, you know, as your, to your point, we're all humans, so anything that you feel, literally millions of other people have felt or are feeling the same thing. And I do think that helps kind of almost dilute those slightly depressing feelings a little bit.
Yeah, and also sometimes it, like, just by getting it out there, it shines a light on things that aren't even true. Like, it's like, you know, when people have anxiety, they're like, oh, I said this stupid thing, they must think I'm an idiot, they hate me, and whatever. And then you ask, or maybe it comes to light, and then they'll go, oh, I completely forgot you said that. Or, like, you know, I haven't even cast a second thought on it.
Yeah.
And people beat themselves up over the most trivial thing. And actually, as soon as you realize that it's not as big a deal as you think sometimes, not to minimize people's feelings, but you know what I mean.
And on that, and by the way, this is going to cut out in a minute and 15 seconds, but quite a nice point just on that to wrap up is, there's a quote. I can't remember who says that. I'm terrible at remembering who says things. I think it was Darren Brown, actually, of all people. He says, I'm terrible at remembering quotes. I'm probably going to butcher this, but we'll give it a go. The sooner you realise... Oh, fuck. The sooner you realise how little... Oh, fuck. Hang on. You start to care less about what people think about you when you realise how little they do.
Yeah, yeah. There it's like go. The spotlight effect, Jesus. Isn't it?
Felt like I was on the spotlight. Yeah.
The spotlight effect of, like, you think everybody's looking at you, but
yeah.
Everybody thinks everyone's looking at
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So you realise that people don't have that much capacity to have that much attention on people.
Yeah.
You've got 30 seconds there to wrap up. There we go.
So don't care what anyone else thinks of you because they're not fucking thinking of you, all right?
Yeah. I think a minute of that was spent on you trying to realise.
Yeah, I know. Cool. Well, mate, thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's been really fun to shoot the shit.
And have an amazing time in South Africa. Boom. All right. Cheers.
Thanks.
Awesome.